This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Wheeler Center on this rainy evening. My name is Chris Flynn. I'm the author of a couple of novels, and I'm also an animal welfare officer at the RSPCA, where I spend a couple of days a week working in the cattery, looking after, believe it or not, sick and injured kittens. There we go. Thank you and good night. First off, I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to the elders of any other communities who happen to be with us tonight. Our guest tonight is Mark Dappin. He is a journalist, an historian, and a novelist. His first novel, as he is fond of reminding me, King of the Cross, won the Ned Kelly Award. And his second, Spirit House, was up for the Miles Franklin, the Age Book of the Year, and the Royal Society for Literature's Ondaatje Prize, which sounds very grand. His third novel, R&R, which we'll be talking about tonight, is set during the Vietnam War. Mark has also edited two books of war writing and written an excellent non-fiction book about Vietnam, The Nashos War, for which he interviewed 150 former National Servicemen, which we'll also be talking about tonight. Now, when Helen at the Wheeler Center asked me to do this event, she had no idea that not only did we know each other, but that we were on tour together last year, and thus developed a pretty intense and bitter hatred of each other. So, with that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome one of my begrudgingly favourite writers, one of my least favourite people, Mark Dappin.
Yeah, well, normally I'd say I'd like to thank Chris Flynn, but I don't want to thank Chris Flynn at all. Yeah. I've got to say, we have been on stage many times before together, but this is the first time we've had an audience that I can recall. Like, we usually speak to two homeless people and a cat. This is incredible.
Well, Mark Dappin, let's address the burning question that's on everyone's lips. When are you going to stop writing books?
You mean, when am I finally going to spare the Australian people the ordeal of reading my books and coming to my events?
Yes.
Well, you, of course, stopped at two, which I'm sure is a failure of both talent and inspiration. I, on the other hand, have a lot more in me. I'm writing another three books as we speak, to the follow-up to R&R, the PhD that I hoped would be Nashos War, but everything in Nashos War was disqualified as evidence for the PhD by the Ethics Committee, so I had to write another book about Vietnam, and a project for Sydney Jewish Museum about Jewish veterans. So I'm not going to stop this year.
Oh, great. Look, they're good books, so keep writing them, I guess.
Okay.
As long as I don't have to keep running into you, I can just pretend someone else wrote them, I suppose. Someone I respect. Like Thomas Keneally, perhaps.
Thomas Keneally. Someone who knows one of the beard things.
Someone who knows what they're talking about. Let's get on with it then, because I never asked you whenever we were on tour, although I sort of kept meaning to, about the fact that you're doing this PhD at the Australian Defence Force Academy. You just mentioned a little bit there, but was that how you came up with the idea for the Nashos War, or was it something that just that you went in wanting to research there?
No, what happened was I was chosen by Penguin to edit the Penguin Book of Australian War Writing, which was an anthology of war writing by those who took part and correspondents, all first-person war writing, from invasion, colonisation, what you want to call it, through to Afghanistan. The reason that I was chosen by Penguin to edit that anthology was not really that I knew anything about war writing, but the publisher of Penguin, Ben Ball, used to be my work experience boy when I was at the Financial Review. Whether he was doing it as a favour to me, giving me the job, or just a humiliation, I don't know. But he gave me the job. And while I was putting the material together, I noticed there was a gap in first-person accounts of Vietnam. There are actually a lot more now since I put the anthology together. But back then, there was very little that had both had literary merit and was written from a national serviceman's point of view. There's a very good book by Barry Hearn and a couple of other memoirs, but not much else. So I went to Penguin and I said, well, we could fill this gap. How about if I interviewed, I proposed interviewing 120 national servicemen and writing what would essentially be a biography of the national service scheme. So I'd use all their experiences chronologically to tell the story of national service. But I was very specific. I wanted to tell the story of national service as it was seen then, not the way it is seen now. I feel this book has, although it's been very generously received, I feel it's been slightly misunderstood. It's not a book about PTSD. It's not a book about what happened after the war. It's a book about the National Service Scheme during the war itself and how it looked then before anybody knew what longer-term effects the Vietnam War National Service might have. Then I thought I'd do a PhD. I kind of thought that I could, the PhD would give me academic guidance because I hadn't written a history book before, although I'd kind of, it'd always been in the back of my mind something I did want to do. And it did. A lot of the things my supervisor said were extraordinarily helpful, but unfortunately, the ethics committee at UNSW would not accept my sampling method for interviewees for the Nashos War. Nor would it allow me to quote by name those people whose witness accounts I was using. They saw it as being very much sort of quantitative study, whereas I saw it as a piece of narrative history. So the two projects became completely distinct. Okay. And now I'm writing another book.
So, I mean, setting out, you obviously intended right from the beginning then to conduct at least 120 interviews, and it ended up being about closer to 150 or something.
Oh, it was a lot more than that. Was it? 150 guys who went. Then I did 12 guys who didn't go for various political or administrative reasons. And now I was completely addicted to the process. I didn't stop. Even when the book was published, I didn't stop. So I've done, probably done another 30 since then.
I mean, was it hard doing these interviews? I mean, thinking both logistically and like tracking these people down, but also emotionally, because you're bringing up a lot of stuff that has been maybe buried for a while.
I've got to say, Vietnam veterans in general are incredibly generous people. They're so generous and open and friendly, and their wives give you cucumber and tomato sandwiches and biscuits. So many biscuits. I didn't eat biscuits before and I haven't had any since. And they take you to the room in their home where they've got their regimental plaque and their photo albums and their memories. It was actually a beautiful sort of trusting experience. But, yeah, it was quite difficult. But it seems ludicrous for me to complain that interviewing someone is difficult when they're talking about being at war. Of the first 90 interviews that I did, probably 60 guys teared up. But when I say that, I don't mean they openly wept. There was a kind of standard. There's a kind of standard response, and I saw it happen in the third episode of the Afghanistan documentary on ABC the other night. I don't know if anyone saw that. It's single tear crying, single tear from one eye. They'd sort of slightly choke up. They'd tip back their head a little to stop a tear from flowing, but it would well up and it yep. would fall. And I, at first, I just had no idea how to handle that. But gradually, I didn't so much get used to it. But I started to say at the start of the interview, and I did, there's a chance you might cry. You know, I just said a tear, don't worry about it, I'm used to it. And they go, I'm not going to cry, I had a great time. And then 90 minutes later, there's this tear thing coming on. Finding the people, again, I cannot overstress the generosity of these blokes. Like, initially I was doing what they call, I'm dignifying it with the term snowball sampling, in that I would find friends of friends of friends So I didn't really put out many ads or many feelers to associations, although it did happen to an extent. I just found a couple of veterans and then did their friends and their friends. But that was because I was trying to build up specific stories from a core, find out every angle on a specific episode. But then I realised that probably two-thirds of the way through the project, I realised I'd have to find specific people who were involved in other episodes. So I began through newspapers or memoirs, basically looking for somebody with an unusual name. That's why there's a few people with quite unusual names in that book, because they're the easiest to find in the internet. Yeah, you're not going to track down a John Brown, but a Steve Baryshnikov, particularly if he comes from, like, Tamworth, probably never left there. So I'd go through and find, I'd look up Steve Baryshnikov, and he would always still be in Tamworth, Mr. S. Baryshnikov. I'd ring him up, and all the conversations went the same way on the phone. I'd go, "Hi, is that Mr. Baryshnikov?" The guy go, "Yeah, mate." And I go, "Are you the Steve Baryshnikov that was in Vietnam?" And he'd go, "Yeah, mate." And I go, "Well, were you in 6th Battalion in 1953 or 1966? And he go, "Yeah, mate." And I go, "My name's Mike Dappin, I'm a historian. I was just wondering if I could talk to you for my book." And he go, "Yeah, mate." And then there'd be a pause and he'd go, "Oh, hang on, I'm just going down to Bolo now, but if you call back at 6, we can talk then." And then I'd either, if I possibly could, I'd make an appointment for a face-to-face. But in the end, I'd been all around the country and I just started doing phoners, which aren't ideal. But then I'd either go around the house or talk to them on the phone, and it was as if they'd been expecting the call, you know, and they just talked and talked and talked.
So was one of the ideas starting out to dispel some of the myths surrounding the Vietnam War, or did that only become apparent once you started conducting the interviews that there was something going on here where it wasn't being remembered the way...
No, it wasn't what I started out with at all. I started out with exactly the same picture of what happened as everybody else. As things went on, I came to a different perspective, but it was never my intention to be a, you know, nasty, sniping, revisionist historian, you know, saying this didn't happen, that didn't happen, and no gas chambers at Auschwitz, that kind of scum. You know, I just wanted to write narrative history.
But it became apparent, a lot of the chapters essentially are about, you know, correcting some of the myths that we may hold in contemporary times about this conflict. And I thought, and that was a real hook for me, it really drags you into the book. Maybe we could run through some of the myths. One of the first ones that you sort of mentioned early on is when you talk about how National Service began, and obviously it was like a lotto machine or something, and they put balls in there and they picked out...
A lotto machine was a barrel.
A barrel, right. Okay, a barrel, and they put in balls and they picked out a certain ball, yeah. And if it had that date on it, that was the date of your birthday.
Each ball was numbered between, say, for the first 6 months of the year, it would be numbered between 1 and 180.
Right.
And obviously 1st of January was number one. The lotto machine was a hardwood barrel. It was actually a TATS barrel. It was the same. They had such a tin ear for this kind of thing. It was the same TATS barrel they drew TATS from.
You've won.
Yeah.
And so they drew out a number, and if that was corresponded to your birthday in from a certain year, then you were off to Vietnam.
You're not off to Vietnam, no, you're into the army.
Yeah.
But from 20 years previously, so when 1965, when the first draw ballot in 1965 came out, it was for men born in the first half of 1945. So there'd be two full draws from the barrel and two subsidiary draws every year, which would lead to four intakes to the army every year.
But just because your number was drawn and it fell on your birthday, that didn't mean you were going to wind up in Vietnam or even the army.
No, right. not at all. I mean, I think one of the first things that I came to realise, one of the first things, I actually couldn't understand it. It really puzzled me because I had this idea from, I guess, American literature and American film that Vietnam was a working class war. That, you know, it was all the poorest kids swept up in a conflict that they wanted no part in. But I didn't meet anyone like that. Everybody I met was, you know, at most lower middle, at least lower middle class, and a lot of them were successful middle class blokes in fields like real estate, in fields like sales, but basically in any field you can imagine. Well, quite a few of them are journalists, a handful of journalists. And I started to realise that the selection process that resulted, that came from the ballot, actually favoured middle class people. It was noted at the time. I didn't get there till quite towards the end of my research. I read that it was noted at the time that so many people were bank clerks in the first intake. Since for my PhD, I've done a statistical analysis. It sounds brainy, doesn't it? I've written some things down and put ticks next to them. Done a statistical analysis of 7th Battalion's two tours, and it looks like a full 10% of men in 7th Battalion, 1st and 2nd tours, were bank clerks and finance workers, which is, I mean, I don't know, I'm sure many more people were bank clerks back then, but it goes to show, I guess, what the Nashos cohort really was socially. It was kids, the army selected the best from what it got from the birth date lottery. What it wanted was boys who were bright and boys who were athletic. In a way, Australian national servicemen weren't some kind of lumpen proletariat who could do nothing but fight. They were a kind of elite. And the social composition of each intake changed with each year. And it gradually it got more and more middle class. Because I don't want to overplay this. Like, it wasn't an army of dentists or anything. Although they were.
There were dentists, so yeah.
Oh, no, the dentists are coming. People are more scared of dentists than they're scared of soldiers anyway.
That's true. But you had to have a certain intelligence to get into the army, right?
You can't be... like people.
If you were a dummy, you didn't get in, right?
No, I mean, if you couldn't read, if you couldn't obey orders, it was well established that as people of a men of the lowest educational achievement would not stay in the army anyway. They couldn't cope with it. They couldn't follow instruction there. But we still had a predominantly working class regular army. The national, and you have to remember, the majority of soldiers in the army, in the Australian army, and the majority of soldiers who went to Vietnam were in fact regular army. And this was majority working class army. But the army wanted to use the scheme consciously to broaden its social base. As at first, as I say, the bank clerks came in. There were deferments allowed for skilled workers. So you could remain outside the army until you completed your apprenticeship. So therefore, in the later intake, skilled tradesmen came in. You were allowed to defer until you finished your degree. So graduates started coming in. You were allowed to defer until you finished your degree and your teaching practice. So then teachers started to come in. And again, a really surprising number of National Service infantry privates were school teachers. And it took me a long time to figure out how this was. And then finally, you start getting people who've deferred their law degree, done their years, whatever it's called. Sorry?
Articles,
thank you. Audience participation, that's what I'm encouraging here. No, thanks. And then people who'd finished their medical degrees. So by 1969, the first doctor came in 1969, then they drafted about 90 of them in 1970, and the doctors were furious. That's the last thing they wanted to do. Of that 90, 48 of them were found by their friends to be medically unfit to go into the army.
I mean, the public were, though, in the 60s, the public were generally in favour of national service, right? Because they thought it was going to straighten out all the hippies and the lowlifes and all the sort of drongos. But that wasn't the demographic of men who went into the army at all, was it?
No, it's all... the idea... I saw this documentary a couple of years ago about the Save Our Sons movement that opened with the property. It showed some... guys going into national service and some protesters, and it called the national service scheme the hated national service scheme. In fact, it was a loved national service scheme at the beginning. And even at the end of the Vietnam War, after everything that had happened, a clear majority of Australians were in favour of the continuation of national service. They just didn't want kids sent to Vietnam or sent to war. They still are always in favour of national service. They're always in favour of military training, of disciplining youth, because, as you said, they had this idea that it would take young tearaways off the streets. But the army's not a... It's not a prison. It's not a reformatory.
Kind of reform
skill, the army doesn't want criminals. And the army said, we're not taking criminals, you know. We want bank clerks, dentists, that kind of folk. And so nobody with a criminal record, nobody that had had a youth magistrate supervision order got in the army anyway. But the government were very careful that this was not overly... It did come out, because somebody said it in Parliament, but it was very rarely commented in. I found some papers in a file that said something like, do not publicise this. It took people generally into the army and into Vietnam who were intelligent, law-abiding and conservative anyway, not young anarchic tearaways. Bodgies was what they were worried about. They thought it would make bodgies get their hair cut.
So who was automatically exempt? There was
The only people... Like, you'd fail your security clearance if you were a communist, and you would, as I say, there were certain criminal types that couldn't get in, but this wasn't openly said. The only people who really were openly exempt were theological students, ministers of religion, and that extremely small cohort of 20-year-olds who were diplomats. I don't even know why they had that, why they bothered. And this was back in the day, everyone was in favour of universal national service for everyone but themselves. Like, so farmers objected, particularly farmers. Farmers were really in favour of national service for people who lived in the city. They'd been farm deferments or the equivalent of in World War II. They couldn't see why they shouldn't be again. Jockeys were very much against national service for jockeys. Because they were concerned that they'd put on too much weight during their 2 years military training and they'd be too heavy for horses. This jockey thing went on for ages until it turned out that the minimum height for the army was 5'4" and the average height for a jockey was 5'2". So some jockeys did get in the infantry, in fact, but they were the taller part of the jockey cohort.
What about this myth of the volunteer? I mean... Were there volunteers? Did conscripts have any sort of choice in the matter?
I almost despair of talking about this because there'll be people in the audience that simply won't accept what I'm going to say. There was different processes in different units, so different processes in different battalions at different times. The army now holds that no man went to Vietnam who was not a volunteer. This is not the case. This is provably not the case. And it doesn't matter how often I say it, people are going to say, well, we were given the chance to volunteer, so you're wrong. But I have a letter from Andrew Peacock to a guy who is named in the book saying, I know that this guy I'm talking about. He said, I'm opposed to the Vietnam War on political grounds. I don't want to go on personal grounds. I just got married and have a kid. If you send me to Vietnam, I will desert. And Peacock wrote back and said, you know, with reference to your letter, the army's needs are paramount. You're going. This exists. I can show it to anybody. And then when the book came out, I got somebody else sent me their service record. This first guy I'm talking about was a radiographer, so it's a very specialist occupation. You can see why the army fought him to get him to go there. This other bloke was a service corps clerk, and his record shows quite clearly he didn't want to go. He refused to sign the papers. There's notes of him saying to his commanding officer he wouldn't go, and he ended up going. So, yes, some people volunteered, some people didn't volunteer.
And so could you be a conscientious objector on religious grounds or political grounds, or were there grounds for that?
You could be a conscientious objector, but at least initially, very few claims for conscientious objection were recognised, and those were only religious ones initially. What the political objections tended to come not from people who were entirely pacifist, but who were objecting to the Vietnam War specifically. And during the course of the Vietnam War, as far as I can remember, it was never established. They never conceded that you could be politically opposed to, say, fighting the Viet Cong, but not fighting the Nazis or whatever.
Let's talk a little bit about the myths surrounding combat and so on. There's actually some very exciting chapters in this where the men are describing what, and it feels a bit guilty sort of saying they're exciting, but whenever they're describing what it is like, boots on the ground in the middle of like pretty nasty firefights. But a few of them talk about how it's quite different to the presentation of combat as we would know from movies. Obviously, mm-hmm. all the generations subsequent to that, their experience of the Vietnam War is through, you know, Oliver Stone's Platoon or Full Metal Jacket, you know, Casualties of War, all Rambo, all these sort of modern, you know, looking back on the Vietnam War tales. But it's very different from the personal recollections of men.
Yeah, I mean, again, I feel slightly fraudulent talking about experience of battle. But the way that they talk about it often was with soldiers in general. I think most soldiers don't so much resent being in battle, don't so much hate being in battle as being bored before and after it. They've been trained to fight, and when they're fighting, you know, if they're not actually enjoying it, then at least they're, you know, very much in the moment. It's a time, you know, when you could be dead when you're very much alive. Some people speak of it like that. Other people, like one of the guys at Long Tan,
yeah,
said everyone at Long Tan would have cried. She said, I was just crying. It's not something you hear of these men bursting into tears, but there's a lot of that. There's a lot of digging as deep a hole as you can with as much of your body as you can and getting as much cover as you can with shell fire, the actual horror of mortars coming in. But there's also, you know, a definite exhilaration.
Yeah, I mean, I was very interested in Second Lieutenant Dave Sabin's account from the Battle of Long Tan when he talks about, you know, artillery shells landing, and it's just sort of, it just lands out of the blue. You don't know it's coming, and it's just steam and smoke, and there's no like people flying off into the bushes the way you see in the movies. It's a completely surreal and gone there one minute, gone the next sort of scenario.
Yeah. Sabin's very good at describing that kind of thing.
The other thing that surprised me too was that the Australian forces are obviously very well trained, you know, Western nation.
You really have read this book, haven't
I you? I did. I really did.
Amazing.
Even though I don't like you. The Australian forces are very well trained, Western nation army. I couldn't believe that they were up against what seemed like pretty steep odds sometimes in Operation Bribie and things like that. I didn't realise that. I just assumed that they were this sort of... I had this myth in my head of them being this super well-trained army who went over there, were put in sort of, you know, fairly innocuous situations. I didn't realise they were up against, that they were outnumbered and so on at some times.
At times, but you have to remember those experiences I used because they were the most exciting and interesting experiences. A lot of the time it was more the way that you understood it, I think. But yes, certainly there were times when they were outnumbered. And I think this isn't really anything I cover in the book, but there is a kind of myth about the military capacity of the NLF, the Viet Cong. Although at a low level they were simply village guerrillas with French-era weapons, they were well-trained, extremely well-motivated Viet Cong military forces as well, outside of any North Vietnamese army. They were, you're not just fighting villagers, you are fighting other soldiers when you're fighting some elements of the NLF.
And so if you're sent out there, National Service, how long is your tour?
So National Service itself, although it could be extended, was 2 years. If you went to Vietnam, you would probably serve a year there, although it could be less. They couldn't make you do more. So some people actually bizarrely only went for a few days. Some went for 3, 6, 9 months, but I would guess the majority did the year.
There's a couple of other interesting things about what happens to them, you know, after that year when they return to Australia. There's a very sort of moving passage talking about the adrenaline rush, and a lot of these guys who, as you say, were just ordinary fellows, farmers, bank clerks and so on, but they had to return to civilian life after that. And there's a great passage later on in the book where the guy talks about just not being able to replace that adrenaline rush of being right in the middle of it.
Yeah, and again, I think that's probably common to all soldiers, but I think there's a kind of uniqueness in the Vietnam War. Now, again, it's something I'm still thinking about. I suspect that there was the 1960s was a period of demographic and occupational change, and that the guys who were bank clerks, say, and school teachers, say, in that decade, in another time, would have had more physically taxing, more demanding, and more outdoor jobs.
Right.
They were never the kind of guys who were suited to being bank clerks anyway. They were just the opportunities that were open to them. But yeah, they came back and they weren't interested at all. And you know, this is a common refrain with veterans of any war. Like people around them cared about tiny things that didn't matter. They get very angry when people complain about, you know, the weather or something when they've been in Vietnam. So they found they didn't fit in. And awful lot of them end up in the COPS. Awful lot of them ended up in the prison service. The COPS actively recruited veterans. And a lot of them ended up on oil rigs. Well, a lot. Some ended up on oil rigs. And they had perhaps more adventurous, some of them, had perhaps more adventurous lives than they would have if they hadn't gone into the army.
Let's talk a bit about the anti-war movement back in Australia, because I think that's one of the huge myths about the 60s, and it's probably been perpetuated a lot in movies and so on since. Obviously, these men returned from their tour of duty, and there's stories about them being, you know, jeered and spat upon, and there were riots at airports when they were coming back, but that wasn't true at all, was it?
Again, I've got to be careful when I talk about this. I do not say that there was never individual hostility towards veterans. What I do say in the book is there is this idea that there were demonstrations against, this specific idea that there were demonstrations against returning veterans at Sydney Airport or any airport, which I do not think these demonstrations ever occurred. That fact does not... I argued this with a veteran who was also wasn't actually a Vietnam veteran, an army guy, who was also an academic, and he said, "But we didn't commit atrocities." So, it seems like there's only two possible viewpoints you can have. Like, they were either, and very few people it seems now hold the idea that they were mercenaries who committed atrocities against civilians, or that they came back and they were, you know, met by demonstrators waving placards calling them baby killers. You can't say, no, they didn't commit atrocities against civilians, and no, they weren't, for the most part, and no, they weren't met by placards calling them baby killers. But I am now convinced there were no demonstrations at airports. There's hundreds of reasons why you cannot stage a demonstration at an airport at midnight, or 6 a.m., which was the only other time the soldiers came in.
Planes came in.
But every single day, it's possible to trace the date that people who say they were demonstrated against at airports came home, and you can look at the newspapers from that date, and there are no demonstrations recorded. And these are newspapers that would record, you know, a demonstrator walking off a footpath if he was waving a placard. Demonstrators were seen as folk devils. They were ratbags. They were delinquents. Apart from a very brief period in 1970, when the press kind of evinced a broad sympathy for the first moratorium demonstrators. Demonstrators were, you know, just lower than low in the minds of conservative Australia. And any time they did anything that was remotely delinquent, it was heavily reported. These things that are so delinquent, demonstrating against returning soldiers at an airport, spitting on them in the baggage handle, you know, it couldn't possibly have gone unreported. But again, I know there's some people who are going to not believe me. So
there were large welcome parades, weren't there?
I'm sorry? Yeah, again, this has been forgotten. The entire conservative population of Australia has been written out of history, and I still don't understand how this is. Like, very few, you know, and again, I don't want to be sort of revisionist. I don't want to say no one was in the peace movement. Of course they were in the peace movement. There were people in the peace movement. Of course it was large compared to social movements in the past, and of course it seeded all the progressive social movements to come. But it was not the majority. A majority of people were never demonstrators. The majority of people, much larger crowds, welcome home some of the battalions from Vietnam than ever demonstrated in a moratorium. But all those people are forgotten. So you see, like the first battalion came back from Vietnam, there's quite a famous sequence of events where a woman called Nadine Jensen, a 20-year-old typist from Campbelltown, doused herself in a mixture of kerosene and red paint and ran at the first guy in the parade, pushed past him and brushed past the next guy in the parade. You know, there was 100,000 people there that day, I think there's actually more than that, who were cheering on the soldiers. And there was one Nadine Jensen who was covered in red paint and a handful of other people in the crowd who were in fact beaten up by the crowd. Those five people, seven people, whatever, are remembered, but 100,000 are forgotten. Now, I really cannot think why this is. And at the time, Nadine Jensen, they couldn't understand at all why she'd done it. The magistrate thought she was mentally ill. They had no idea why a woman would douse herself in paint and throw herself at a returning soldier. And again, now, that image of Nadine Jensen, you know, as kind of avenging bride of blood, yeah, everybody knows it. But back then, they didn't. It wasn't a big thing. It was like a lunatic, you know, it was just like somebody having a psychiatric episode. What they remembered then was the parades. What we remember now is the demonstrations. And I don't really understand when that changed. I don't know when Conservative Australia wrote itself out of history.
We'll go to questions pretty soon because we're flying through. But before we do, let's have a little sort of segue onto R&R, your novel. Now, this is a detective mystery novel, I guess, set in Vung Tau, which is where Australian servicemen took their leave. I made the mistake of reading this first, and I wish I'd read.
Oh, you're saying I made the mistake of reading.
I made a terrible mistake of reading this book.
Fling comes out.
I read this first, and I wish I'd read the Nashua's War first because it really contextualizes this and sort of gives a lot of background to this. So I'm presuming this came out of your research for the Nashua's War and the fact that you had detailed accounts of what life was like in Vung Tau, particularly for the military policemen there.
Yeah, well, it came out. I was very interested in those people. Right from the start of the project, I was interested in blokes who didn't fight. I was interested in the troops they call pogos, you know, people who were essentially doing the same job in the army as they would have done in civilian life. I was interested in the sociology of it. I was interested in how the organisation coped with them and how they coped with the organisation. And a couple of these guys, I was interviewing them, and they loved it. They loved being in Vung Tau. It was the best time of their lives. You know, they had girls, they had drink, they had
the beach.
Some of the worst surf in the world.
Yeah.
But strangely enough, they had a surf life saving club, although lives were not at risk in the surf at Vung Tau. And, you know, it's clear now, even nowadays, there's a colony of Australian Vietnam veterans living in Vung Tau, reliving the best days of their life. There's about 30 who live there full-time and about 60 who are part-time, who've married it's unfair to say the daughters of the bar girls that they knew then, but, you know, similar women, I guess. So I was interested in their experience. And I only realised this very, very recently. I grew up in a garrison town. I grew up in Aldershot, the home of the British Army. And in a way, part of R&R, part of my idea of Vung Tau, I think, is actually Aldershot. But yeah, perhaps that's where my interest in this idea of a garrison town came from. I'll just ask myself the hard questions, you know, the psychology. I'll do the analysis. You sit there.
Suits me.
As I've told you. No. Anyway, so yeah, this veteran started telling me this story about when it rained very hard in Vung Tau, because Vung Tau was built partially on sand dunes, it could rain so hard that the hills would open up and coffins of recently buried Vietnamese people would come out of the hills and float down into town. And I didn't really believe it. I thought it might be true, it might not be true, but it was a very colourful image. And then I found the same anecdote in a memoir of a boat person who'd lived in Vung Tau and settled in the US. So I thought, oh, well, maybe it did happen. Still, maybe it was a folk story. And I thought, well, what if that were me? Like, I was dead in a coffin, ground opened up, and I kind of flowed into town, and the town I flowed into was Vung Tau, you know, a town of bars and brothels. And I thought, well, I'd go for a drink, obviously, apart from the fact, you know, I'd be dead. So the opening chapter of my novel has this corpse in a coffin come into the bar. Some soldiers open up, American soldiers open up the coffin, take him to the bar, buy him a drink, give him a cigarette, and then someone comes in and shoots him. And why any of that occurs is the mystery at the heart of Vung Tau, of R&R rather. There's also some debate over whether it's a crime to shoot somebody who's already dead in a bar. But I... So I struggled with that first chapter for ages, but luckily... And some people have said it's not realistic, really. I didn't know that. But even though it wasn't realistic, I wanted there to be some kind of possibility. So my best mate from school, luckily for me, is now an undertaker. And I met him at a party in England. And I said, look, I'm writing this novel where corpse is taken out of a coffin and sat in a bar and given a drink. Can you sort of tell me how that might happen? He goes, oh, yeah, mate, easy. And I said, how? And he goes, it wouldn't. He said, corpses don't drink. And you know, this has been pointed out since by reviewers. It's each time, damn, what can I say? But we did basically work out some way by we could get around rigor mortis and certain bones that you might have to break and positions that you have to be in, whereas eventually my mate would concede. I gave him it to read in the end that it was possible just that somebody could take a corpse out of a coffin, sit him up and give him a drink. But then he said to me, what is it you actually think undertakers do?
The murder of the corpse is basically the start point for the book, and it all opens up a huge can of worms after that. A can of worms.
Yeah, I got that too.
Well, that wasn't planned.
He's not very careful about his language, is he?
So you went there, right? You went to...
I went there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went there with a veteran, my mate, trying to find a suitable hill that the coffin could have come off. So we're wandering around looking at hills, and there are hills there. And this guy, I chose him. He's a regular army guy, very bright, living with a Vietnamese woman, did two tours of Vietnam in the artillery. So I chose him for his military experience, his knowledge of Vietnamese, and indeed his knowledge of the topography of Vung Tau. What I didn't realise was he was also Vietnam's premier soil bore. So wherever we went, I'd go, what about that hill? And he goes, that hill, mate, that's alluvial soil with a 23% basalt content. If it rained, it wouldn't open up, it would close up. I go, all right, what about that hill? Laterite, mate, laterite. But eventually, we couldn't find a hill with the right kind of mix of soil and sand. But eventually we found a suitable geographical, we found a spot anyway where it all might have happened if I situated the bar in a particular place.
What about the central characters, the two military policemen, Nashville and Shorty? Are they based on real guys or a mixture of accounts from real military policemen?
Not really. They're not really. The guy, Shorty, is a caricature, sort of a caricature of the self-image that some national servicemen had of themselves as being completely unworldly. And yet not stupid, just people who didn't know. And, you know, it was the truth in many respects about many people. Errol Nowak, the first National Serviceman to die in Vietnam, didn't know where Vietnam was. He thought it was a place in... They thought it was a part of Thailand, a city in Thailand. So he's very unworldly. And he teams up with an American military policeman, Nashville, who is very worldly. But it's a conceit more than anything. It's, you know, it's not supposed to be a realistic novel. It's a parable and a satire. Although it's, I don't know, I keep getting these letters from veterans saying how realistic and true it is, and that just astonishes me. Because maybe, you know, they take dead people out for a beer and stuff.
You must have dozens of ideas for novels after doing all this research, though. I mean, is there just so many stories that come up that you think, oh, that would make a good one?
Not really. That, oh. No. You're wrong.
Good.
I've used it all in Nash Ho's War. You know, I had a very few primitive insights and I've milked them for all they're worth.
Right, okay. We've got just over 10 minutes left, folks. It's hard for me to see, but I believe there's microphones out there. Is anyone interested in asking a question to Mark Dappin? I can't.
Is anyone still away?
Can't really imagine why, but I guess the people with the microphones will pick you out if you're there. There we go.
Hey, g'day. I enjoyed R&R a lot. I thought it was very funny. And I'm from around Bendigo as well. My dad served in Vietnam, so I thought Shorty was a good person to get to know because I thought he gave me some insights into who Dad might have been. But I was a bit curious, where do you go with the sequel? I mean, Shorty's done his service. Nashville's had his saga. The big reveal at the end. What happens now? Do you, more people come to Vietnam? You tell their stories? What happens?
No, it's actually a completely consecutive follow-up to R&R. So it starts about 2 months later. So Shorty's year isn't yet up at the end of R&R and nor is Nashville's tour. So it's about the tail end of their tour when the situation in Vung Tau, which in my version, my fantasy version, is under control of certain gangster elements. The balance of power between the gangster elements changes and a new situation becomes the norm in Vung Tau. But it's also about... It's also an attempt to write the book that I think some of the reviewers of R&R apparently wanted me to write. R&R has also been criticised because there aren't many female characters. Like, that's my fault. Like, it's down to me, the fact that women weren't in the Australian Army in the Vietnam War, apart from a small number of nurses. I do take the point, and I do tend to write too much about men. So this new book does have what are hopefully solid, rounded female characters who aren't prostitutes in it. Hey.
Thanks, Mark. Very interesting. Can you just comment on the relationship between the Nashos and the regular soldiers?
It's funny, like there seemed no doubt at all that when they were in Vietnam, when you were in Vietnam, Nashos and regulars worked without distinction together. They were simply parts of a team. I think possibly elements of the Nasho cohort thought the regs were potatoes with clothes on, with uniform on. I think maybe some regs thought the Nashos were a bit up themselves, and they certainly initially thought the Nashos, right at the beginning, they thought the Nashos wouldn't be up to it. They thought they were mummy's boys. They resented the dilution of the army with this element that, you know, were not vocational soldiers. But I think that there's no difference at all when they were actually out there. It's interesting now, I suspect, you know, a lot of Vietnam veterans pretty much define themselves as Vietnam veterans socially now, hang out with other veterans. It seems to me that the Nashos probably hang out disproportionately with other Nashos now. But at the time, I don't think there was much of a difference.
Was there proportionally more Nashos killed than there was regular army soldiers? Am I getting that right?
They were Nashos were disproportionately in the infantry, right, and died in disproportionate numbers as a result. But they're small figures. But it's because the infantry had the greatest demand for the greatest number of men, and because infantry was one of the more dangerous jobs, and because national servicemen tended to be privates rather than, I mean, very few were sergeants, a number were corporals, they tended to be at the sharp end of a patrol, and as a result of that, more Nashos proportionately tended to die in infantry roles. At the beginning.
There's a microphone coming here.
I'm very interested in the social implications of the Australian soldiers being in Vietnam, particularly the mixed-race children. Was there any conversations about those social consequences?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the something children.
Mixed-race. Oh. Australian children.
No, that didn't ever come up. Well, did one guy, a dentist, in fact. It's going to seem like I'm obsessed with dentists. And I did. I really did try to find a National Service dentist because I was interested in the experience of a dentist. I don't know why. One dentist actually adopted a Vietnamese orphan, but I don't think anybody... I can't recall anybody saying that they knew they'd left a child behind. When I went to Vietnam for the first time, long, long time ago, it would have been 1994... the Ciclo driver took us to an orphanage for mixed-race children of GIs, and because the who I believe subsequently, I think most of them were adopted out to Americans, and because the Vietnamese don't really know that Australia was in the war anyway, they may well have thought that Australian children were GIs' children, but beyond that, it didn't really come up.
Any further questions for Mark? There's a gentleman over there. Or I'm assuming it's a gentleman. It is.
Well, thanks. This is rather more an observation than a question. In fact, a couple of observations rather than a question. I was called up in the first intake, and I was able to defer for 4 years until 1969. So I went in the first year in a period when there were a lot of graduates going in, so it was a different mm-hmm. cohort to many of the others. But the thing that struck me at the time was not so much the class issue that you were talking about, or the lack of perhaps of class distinctions, but the fact that there were so many young people coming in, we shouldn't forget that these were 18-year-old kids, and many of them came from the country. Many of them had never been to the capital city of the states they lived in. They'd never flown in a plane. It was a much more innocent period, and they came in with very different views as to what they were doing there and where they were going to go. For many of them, it was a way to get false teeth and a war service homes loan and a bit of adventure. And so they went off in a quite different... those who went to Vietnam went off in a quite different frame of mind to those who did not. Another point that was raised earlier on about did everybody who was... a number came out of the barrel, have to go. No, you've answered that already. But there were some very specific ways of avoiding national service. One was on psychiatric grounds. At the time, homosexuality was illegal in the Australian Armed Forces, such that if you were in the armed forces and you were convicted of something, you could end up in jail, in military prisons.
That's true. I should have said that gay men weren't allowed in.
I mean, that was an issue.
Yeah.
But for people who said they were gay, then there were complications for them outside when they're getting employment and so on. But I must say, early on in recruit training, it resulted in some extraordinary attempted couplings, which were quite, which didn't seem to get their, the perpetrators very far.
Well, there's actually two gay relationships in my book. One of them is pretty much at the heart of the 1966, 67 experience, involving Lorenzo Montezini. Some of you may remember, but please carry on.
I think I probably got about as far as I was going to go. Another thing I was going to say was, if you were smart and if you'd had time to think through the issues in a way that some of these younger kids didn't, you could often find a way of steering yourself into a position where you could be placed somewhere in the armed services structure in Australia that meant that you really, your chances of going to Vietnam were much less. And I do know one
That's
case...
That's true as well, yes.
And I know one case, at least, of somebody who joined the same time as I did, who, after 6 to 9 months, was able to make a case for conscientious objection and was discharged.
I mean, this is a point that should be made, I think. The majority of national servicemen never went to Vietnam. Say there were 63,000, more or less, did national service. It now looks like 15,300 went to Vietnam. So it's a very small number. There are absolutely forgotten cohorts of national servicemen who went to Papua New Guinea, largely as teachers, because the army had so many teachers and nothing to do with them. It bundled them all off to Papua New Guinea. About 120, I think, I might be wrong there, ended up as chalkies, and some of them, it was the time of their lives. And there were deployments to Malaysia. The back end, I guess, the bits of the Malaysian, so-called Malayan emergency, was still going on. But the majority of national servicemen stayed at home. They were base soldiers, or they were from infantry battalions that were not rotated to Vietnam in the year that they were there. That is the real national service experience, I guess. The Nashos War. I say at the beginning, I'm not calling the book the Nashos War because I believe that Vietnam was National Servicemen's War. It was a regular soldiers' war more, and national servicemen weren't particularly involved in war in general. But the war that I am talking about in that book is the war that national servicemen fought. Not anyone asked me why I called it that.
Ladies and gentlemen, down at the very back there you'll see the Sun Bookshop, and they have all of Mark's books for sale.
Some of my books.
All of them, I think.
No.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, you're let off the hook a little bit there.
All the ones I still get royalties from are the ones they've got.
I am not a big reader of military history, but I loved this book, I have to say. I really did love it. I had a great time reading this, and so I would highly recommend The Nashos War. It wouldn't have normally been the thing I would read. Mark's novels I've been a fan of, despite all my the obvious antagonism between us. I've been a fan of his books for a long time, ever since I reviewed his second book, Spirit House, on the ABC. I didn't know him from Adam at all, and I love how he incorporates something that a lot of writers forget to incorporate in novels, and that is humour. So he'll take difficult situations and put humour in there, and it just makes them so readable. So he is actually one of my favourite authors, even though one of my least favourite people. So I would highly recommend that you buy his books and probably read this one before. Ideally, buy them both and read this one first, and then read R&R afterwards, because then that'll give you a good bit of background and context for that. But that's about it from us, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming tonight. Please thank Mark Dappin.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I'm excited to be coming back to Melbourne with this show that I know sounds totally ridiculous, but I swear is actually pretty great. It's a collaboration between me and the Monica Bill Barnes Dance Company. That's right, Dance Company. So I tell stories, they dance, two art forms that have no business being on stage together, now together at the State Theatre. I hope to see you there.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.